This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. Hold on just a sec. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. Let me make a quick musical interlude while I tell people to be quiet. All right, back again. Anyway, this is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. I have two lovely guests on today. J.D. Beltran, an artist from San Francisco, and Mike Arcega, an artist as well from San Francisco. Hi, Gus.
Hello.
Good afternoon. I guess it's not morning anymore.
It's true. Sorry about that. So why don't you you guys start off maybe just with a little bit of about yourself, maybe your website or something for people listening along. J.D.?
Do you want to go? Okay. I'm a San Francisco artist. I got my MFA from the San Francisco Art Institute and in 1998, and I specialize in, I guess if you want to call it specialize, in investigating themes of portraiture. Started out as a painter, and now I do all kinds of portraits in all kinds of media, and I'm also faculty at the San Francisco Art Institute now.
Okay. Do you have a website or something on the web that people can check out?
I don't, so you just have to Google me.
Google me, baby. Mike, what about yourself?
I went to the Art Institute also, undergrad, and I do mostly sculpture, but installation, performance, painting, video, and everything else kind of falls within that loose umbrella called sculpture, I guess. Website. I have my personal website, which is just pretty straightforward. It's arcega.us. And I also have some stuff at Heather Marks Gallery, heathermarksgallery.com.
Okay. So kind of just for a brief rundown, what are some of the projects, JD, that you're working on right now?
There's a couple of projects I'm working on this year. One is coming up in July. July 19th through the 22nd, there's going to be an interactive media festival called the Ingenuity Festival in Cleveland, Ohio. The curator, Steve Dietz, who was the media curator at The Walker and now is an independent curator specializing in new media work. He also curated the 01 Festival in San Jose this last year. And for that, I'm doing an interactive project that I actually did back in 2001, and I'm updating it, called Telephone Story, where it's an interactive surface where someone can knock on the surface and hear my telephone messages with a companion video that I've collected over 2 years.
So when you say knock on the surface of?
There's this really big screen that's about 4 feet high by 6 feet wide. In Cleveland, it's actually going to be a storefront, so anybody walking by any time of day or night can walk up to it and start knocking on the window, and when they knock on the interface, they'll get a set of messages, and there's a set of messages from my mom and from people
What does your mom say?
She leaves messages about asking how I'm doing. They're very mom messages, and I'm sorry, you have a cold, you have to call me, you have to drink orange juice. And then I also have this whole set of messages. I don't know, did you see this piece, Mike?
Mm-mm.
It was at Camera Work in 2003. And a set of messages I collected from all these guys I was dating. And so you get this companion video of all of these men walking by that is very pixelated because I wanted to anonymize it, I guess.
Okay. Sounds good. And that's in Cleveland, right?
That's going to be in Cleveland, yeah.
Okay. Mike, what about yourself? What have you got coming up?
I've got a couple things, a few things lining up for the year. Got a show in LA, a group show at a new gallery called Steve Turner Contemporary. And then actually, I'm going to be in a show in the Philippines called the Manila Galleon Trade, which I made a Manila Galleon a while ago. And then a show that's traveling is going to end up at the Berkeley Art Museum in the fall. And another show is traveling called The Landscape of War from Mill Valley to the San Jose ICA, and was curated by Anve.
Sounds good. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your Manila Folder Galleon. It happens to be one of my personal favorite pieces out there. And
mine too.
I think it's a neat intersection of I would say humor and kind of sculptural craftsmanship as far as being able to not only make something that is cool from across the board from like kids to adults, but something that actually floats as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, kind of the deep kind of desire to make it, I think, stems from being a kid, I guess. I saw a friend's little brother's science experiment project for their class was about buoyancy, and they had to make paper cardboard box duct tape boats, and to see how much water they displaced or how much a piece of cardboard can hold, a cardboard box can hold. So I've always wanted to make my own cardboard box duct tape boat, and so the and actually ideally I'd go and fish in a lake or something, but I ended up this opportunity to propose this project came up, and just a little tweaking of materials and a lot of research, and somebody had mentioned the Manila galleon trade and its kind of connection between California, Mexico, and the Philippines, and it was kind of ideal for the show, which never happened, but I ended up getting a solo show, and that's what I directed the project to, is that Lucky Tackle, which is now Blank Space. So,
and you actually launched it, right?
So it's a
for the listening public, like maybe we'll just tell you kind of what it is, other than the Harley going by outside. You constructed a full Spanish galleon out of Manila, or folders, rather, and called it the Conquistador.
Yeah, it's El Conquistador. I wanted to kind of parody the Great Conqueror, right? But kind of make him kind of dorky, because I can't pose as a conqueror. I don't know if you've seen me, but
now come on, Mike. Come on.
I guess I could pose.
This is Radio Land.
I have posed as a conqueror. Yeah, I'm actually 6'9".
Strapping,
good looking. Centimeter. Whoa. Easy.
So there's more commentary on. Your stature? Would you say?
No. All right. So it's a. I wanted to parody our stance. The United States stance as a conqueror, also through the Spaniards, which I find really interesting because of my heritage, being Filipino, and it was a combination of those things, a historical background, the current stance of the United States, the historical background, the desire to make a cardboard box duct tape boat, and wanting to craft things. So I ended up making a 10-foot Spanish galleon made out of Manila folders.
The question, you sailed it in the bay.
In Tomales Bay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the question, obviously, people ask you, how the hell didn't it sink?
Epoxy resin.
Paper.
It resined. It's got a wood frame, and then it's resined.
Weren't you afraid you put your foot through the bottom?
I had to make a compartment on the bottom to hold ballast. Like it was actually, I enlarged a model ship because I couldn't find plans. So the plans that I got were was a model ship that I reconfigured the interior of so I could fit in it, but also put ballast in it so it wouldn't topple over. And then I got a rudder design from a kayak. So I built that into the design, and then it took about a year, and I don't know, after going to work.
So JD, yourself as well, you've been used to using kind of materials that aren't necessarily standard materials for, you know, making art projects, even kind of more sculptural stuff as well. I know one of your projects that I saw personally down at the Isaiah Festival down in San Jose was the Secrets Project. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. As I was saying earlier, one of the things I'm trying to do is explore different ways that you can portray people and, you know, make a portrait rather than the traditional photograph or painted portrait that we're used to seeing. And this project actually started in 2003. And what I did was I started soliciting people to send me secrets over the internet and anonymously, because I gave them a website address and that they wouldn't have to have their email identified. And so for the last, I guess, 2007, it's 4 years, people sent me their secrets and I would cull them. And without any editing, I would add a companion video. And then what I took with, and I would show them in the form of subtitles. So you would see these pretty brief, usually pretty brief secrets that were anywhere from, you know, 30 seconds to 2 minutes long to read, subtitled on this video that I would accompany it with. And I installed this particular, these particular secrets hidden in various areas in this bar cafe at the San Jose Museum, where I carved holes in the bar and carved holes in the cafe tables and hid them underneath, and then would cut out a hole in the actual table so they would, the monitor would show through. But then I would conceal them with coasters or with salt and pepper shakers so they wouldn't be discovered, and that was on, you know, that was a decision I wanted to make because I wanted them to be secret and to be discovered.
Well, I mean, so when you say secrets, what kind of, you know, everybody wants to know, what's the juice, what's the dirt, what kind of secrets were they?
They're, you know, well, one of the most interesting things about the whole project was, first of all, a year later, Frank Warren launched his post-secret project, which was in, I think he started in 2004.
Oh, what a guy.
I don't know if it was just the zeitgeist, but it was really interesting because so many people emailed me, hey, this guy's doing the same thing you're doing, but when I think it was just some, you know, it was probably an idea that was meant to be executed by many people just because it seems kind of obvious if you have something like the internet. But some of the secrets that came through, I mean, like one of the ones that, probably one of the first ones was, I have a secret fear I might be Jesus. And another one was, I have this secret fear that whenever I get a sharp knife in my hand, I'm going to stab the nearest person with it.
Wait, what?
wait, that was my secret.
Wait, somebody sent you my secret?
But what was a little bit sad and poignant was that I'd say 75% of the secrets had to do with relationships or secret relationships or unrequited relationships or affairs and sex. I mean, you know, that's probably not a secret. that's something that's really...
The secret is sex, people.
Yeah, that people really think about and that really affects them.
Really? Did you... So, I mean, did...
I mean, relationships, not necessarily sex.
Right.
Maybe,
well, I mean...
Maybe both.
Hopefully part of it for you, you know? So, you said that you made companion videos to go with that.
Right.
Did you just take... you know, video footage that you had already shot and then kind of marry that with it? Or did you try
exactly.
to kind of, you know, portray the secret in a visual format?
No, it was a former. I mean, just part of my practice is I constantly carry around a video camera. And now with the new digital cameras, they get smaller and smaller. And whenever I see some form of moving image that I think is really interesting and attractive, I'll shoot footage of it. So I end up having this library of all of this footage I've collected over the years, actually, and every once in a while I get to catalog it so I can actually use it. And what I did was to try to pick conceptually something that fit that I had shot to go with the secret. So, for example, one of the secrets, which I think is one of the saddest, is about this man who met his soulmate, but it was, you know, 15 years too late, and he was already married, and she was already married, and he continues to see her, or at least talk to her every day. But both of them are in relationships they can't leave because they have kids. And what happened was I had come home one day, and just as I was walking in the house, somebody had paid, you know, somebody had had an airplane writing a message in the sky that said, "I heart you." And so that was, I took the video of that fading. Because someone had just written that in the sky, and it was sort of fading, so you could barely read it. Mm-hmm. And that was the video that accompanied that secret.
Huh. How? That totally got me a little misty. How many would you say were kind of sad, like you said, sadder secrets versus kind of, you know, kind of more mischievous, you know, happier secrets, what have you?
It's funny that you should say that. I've never thought about it that way. I don't necessarily think that there is a happy secret.
Hmm. Ooh.
I mean, that's why it's a secret, right?
Right.
Think about it.
Mike, well, what do you think about that?
I don't think there's got to be happy secrets, right? It's like, you know, I like to squish my toes, but I guess I don't know.
Squish your toes
in the dirt. I didn't finish my sentence. I interrupted myself.
I like to smash my hand. this is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyrie, and I have on two artists, J.D. Beltran and Mike Arcega. Michael Arcega or Mike Arcega?
Either way.
How about Mikey Arcega?
Sure.
So the theme of today's show is madness. And we've been talking about earlier programming today was talking about madness. And one of the things that I see kind of pertaining to the art world and madness right now is definitely the consumer market. And I mean, both of you guys sell work to make a living, no? All right. So, but you definitely sell work.
Sometimes.
I mean, ideally you sell work.
Yeah, okay. Ideally.
So I was hoping to kind of get your commentary, both being working artists, what you think about the art market right now. And I mean, I just got back from the Armory Fair in New York, and that being like the mega mall of art right now, and almost completely the same setup as a mall. And except the thing that they're selling, you know, is, you know, $2 million paintings instead of, you know, $39.99 slacks. Mm-hmm. What are you guys' thoughts on the art market?
I haven't been to Basel, Miami, which I have heard about from several friends, or any of, I've been to the Armory in years mm-hmm. before. And it's always this very mixed experience for me as an artist, in the sense that I'm both happy that artists have a venue to be able to make a living, you know, in a way beyond just the gallery system. Because if you think about it, if you have a show in a gallery, it's up for three weeks if they show monthly, and, you know, maybe 2 months if they show on a two-month system. And certain people will walk through the gallery, but it's a pretty limited audience, and the show goes down, and the best you can hope for is that it gets reviewed and there's a graphic so that you might get exposure beyond that. So that can be really frustrating, especially if your gallery shows you in only every couple of years. And at least the art fairs do show annually, and it gives people a little taste of your work, and you know that the people who are going to go there are the people who are actually looking to buy work. Because not everybody who goes to gallery shows is there to buy work, but people who go to art fairs are usually there to buy work. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I can't fault it, but at the same time, I think I'm disturbed by sort of this weird frenzy that has come about in the last couple of years, where, you know, some of the big artists like John Curran is selling his paintings for something like $500,000.
We're talking for the radio listening audience, like a smaller painting. It's not like, you know, a 20-foot fresco on the side of, you know, your house. It's like a 4-foot painting.
Yeah, and that blows me away. I'm totally happy for John Curran, but I'm also disturbed that when there's this layer of commerce and, you know, and art becomes this weird currency, that there's no sort of objective standard or merit. It's really about the reputation of the artist and this kind of bidding frenzy that occurs in this situation, that especially for artists who don't necessarily make art because of that, I guess.
Right. Mike, you?
Well, yeah, I kind of have a similar take on how it's mixed in terms of a place where, like JD was saying, artists could have exposure beyond the gallery. And it's great for galleries in smaller cities, like consider San Francisco a smaller city, where the collectors wouldn't necessarily come and look at these galleries here, but our galleries are able to go to the commercial centers of the art world and show their artists off. And the Bay Area artists are really popping. They're everywhere, and they're doing really great. But they're not seen here. They're seen elsewhere, either art fairs or other shows outside of here. So it's a good way to kind of get our peeps out too. But then there's that uber commercial thing that makes it disturbing, because that becomes the focus, like JD was saying. I mean, people are just talking about, oh, so-and-so got this, sold that, you know, and the kind of politics gets beyond the actual work. And then, you know, but at least I almost would rather have a buzz around art than have a buzz around, you know, the latest shoe design or something. I don't know.
Do you have something against shoes?
No, I need some. Can I borrow yours?
One of the things that does bother me, and I actually see this because I teach, you know, I teach graduate students and undergraduates at the San Francisco Art Institute, is I think this new, what I would call a new prevalence, because in the dot-com age, you know, the art market was dead, and now we're 7 years later and it's hotter than ever. I think it feeds this really dangerous expectation from people who are learning and getting their graduate and undergraduate degrees in art now, that, you know, they can make a certain kind of art that looks a certain kind of way and that has this commodifiable value and attraction, and then they can really make it, and that they want to be part of that, which I think is not a great motivation for making art. Yeah. And you can really get sucked up in that in a really unhealthy way.
How often do you, sorry to interject, how often do you see that in new students where they're like, okay, so John Curran's painting these kind of mannerist elongated figures, they're selling like crazy, so why the fuck not? I'm going to paint some elongated figures with some kind of, you know, maybe pastel-y colors in there and a turkey, and maybe I'll sell it, you know? Like maybe the gallery will pick me up at 49 Gary or something.
I actually don't think John Curran is a great example for that, because I think he's a master. He's incredible.
True.
He is just a consummate artist. His paintings take a really long time to execute.
What about maybe more along your Damien Hirst lines?
Okay, well, and even Damien Hirst is kind of a hard comparison because he's been around the block for a long time. The funny thing was when I was in graduate school in the mid-90s and late 90s, when there was that huge art boom before the crash. Mm-hmm. So I saw a similar phenomena. And I actually went to school with other fellow grad students who their main purpose there was becoming an art star.
Right.
And I would say that one of the things that it affects is the art making itself, where people start to make art for an audience and for a market rather than to make art for art. And if that's a conceptual project, that's fine. I mean, as long as I guess it's well done and interesting. But if you're really making art so you can sell it, you can get caught in this dangerous trap where your art practice becomes defined by what sells rather than an interesting art idea.
Yeah, but I guess somebody could make the argument, why not? What's wrong with selling commercial work? What's wrong with selling a kind of a knockoff version of Damien Hirst? I'm not saying that.
So are you telling us about your new line?
Yeah, by the way, I've got a new line.
So quickly, because we kind of got to wrap it up here. Okay. Isn't it crazy how half an hour goes?
Yeah.
Just tell me about it. Why don't you guys just kind of give us a brief rundown of where you're going to be showing again, or maybe websites where they can, listeners can find out what you've got on the table coming up, Mike? Or JD? Oh, I like that.
Well, the Ingenuity Festival is, I think, ingenuityfestival.org. I also show through Haynes Gallery, which is haynesgallery.com. And
which is in 49 Gary.
Yeah, at 49 Gary in San Francisco. And then this year I'm also involved in, I got this incredibly generous grant from the city of San Jose to do a public art project downtown San Jose, which was supposed to launch in April, but which will now probably end up launching at the end of the summer.
Okay. Sounds good. Mike?
So, again, a show in L.A. in May, a show in the Philippines in June, and then Bay Area in the fall. So at the Berkeley Art Museum and the ICA in San Jose, and hopefully things work out, something in the city.
And one thing I forgot to add, but there's a new issue of Satellite Magazine, and you can get it through the independentschoolofart.org. That has just come out, and my work as well as the work of some other people, alumni from the San Francisco Art Institute, is in it.
Beautiful. Cool. Thank you guys so much for being on the radio.
Thanks for having us, Zephyr.
This is 88.9 Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. And I've had J.D. Beltran and Mike Arcega on. Thanks so much.
And in a bathroom stall off the National Mall, how he kissed so sweetly.